Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. According to the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics, six of the top 20 job growth occupations over the next decade will be in computing and computing technology. By 2020, there'll be 1.4 million open jobs in computing. But according to my guest today, women are on track to fill only about 4% of those jobs. Research shows, in fact, that the share of women in the computing workforce has declined from 37% back in 1995 to less than 25% today. Reshma Sajani is hoping to change that trend. In 2012, she founded a national nonprofit titled Girls Who Code to equip girls with the skills to pursue those jobs and, more importantly, to counter a strong cultural bias that pushed women away from math, science, and technology fields. So far, Girls Who Code have reached over 10,000 women, and founder Reshma Sajani's next step is a book for young women ages 8 to 12, introducing girls to coding and, more importantly, to address those socializations that push young women away from STEM fields. Reshma Sajani is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Reshma Sajani, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich, for having me.
When you started Girls Who Code, you saw this decline in the number of women going into computing fields. And certainly when you look at the future trends, it looks even worse than what trends are now. Why do you suppose the number of women have declined? I mean, you went from over a third of the workforce to less than a quarter of the workforce now, and you're looking at even less down the road.
Yeah. In 1995, almost 40% of the computing workforce was female, and today it's less than 25%. I think a lot of it has to do with culture. You know, I would say you can't be what you cannot see. And when girls think of a computer scientist, and I've asked this question all across all 50 states, you know, they think of a boy sitting in a basement somewhere, he's wearing a hoodie and he's drinking a Red Bull, and he's staring at a screen. And that doesn't seem interesting to them. And they look at that image and they see that on television, whether it's on HBO, Silicon Valley, or in magazines or in movie social network. And they think, you know, not only do I not want to be him, I don't even want to be friends with him. So we have to change cultural images of what girls see a computer scientist is. And that's what this book is all about. You know, it's about five relatable characters that look like these girls, look like American girls. And it's the story of computer science told through their voices.
Well, now, as you actually look at the reality of the computing fields and certainly a lot of technology jobs, it's more than an image. Sometimes it is a reality within the workplace in which you're encouraged this sort of dormitory living in which, they're wearing a hoodie and drinking a Red Bull, and they might not have bathed in a couple of days. And more increasingly, you're seeing that sometimes as a reality, it's a field in which, in certain workplaces, women have not seemed welcome.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's you have to flood the gates, and that's what we've been doing at Girls Who Code. You know, we've taught over 40,000 girls in all 50 states over the past 5 years alone. And to put that into perspective, Rich, only 40,000 people graduated in computer science, of which less than 10,000 were women. So none of this changes, like the workforce doesn't change unless you flood the gates with women. And that's, again, you know, what we're trying to do with this book, because you know, part of the problem is, Rich, is that so many of our communities, girls and boys don't have access to Wi-Fi in the schools or at home. And so it's hard to learn computer programming if you don't have that. And so what we really did is tried to put the philosophy of our curriculum in a book. So, you know, if you don't have Wi-Fi at home, you can pick up this book and understand the fundamentals of computer science, because technology is changing everything about the way we live and work, and we can't leave girls behind.
How did you get the idea for Girls Who Code?
Well, 2012, you know, full disclosure, I'm not a coder. I'm a really weird person to have started this movement. I was terrified of math and science growing up. And in 2010, I ran for Congress, and I saw the gender divide in our schools when it came to technology classes. And I was like, this is strange. And I really wanted to understand it, especially at a time, right, where women are the majority in college, right, the majority in labor force, 45% of all of America's breadwinners. Where are we in these jobs that are shaping our future and where you can make an incredible wage? I mean, Rich, you can make $120,000 as a software programmer. That's a huge opportunity to pay for the mortgage and put food on the table. And so I wanted to understand this. And, you know, I started Girls Who Code as an experiment. I thought, wow, a summer program is the best way to intervene. I borrowed a friend's conference room. I handpicked my first 20 girls, and we taught them how to code. And 5 years later, we've taught 40,000. Our programs are free. You know, we serve girls from all walks of life. And the thing is that what started happening a couple of years ago is that our programs were starting to be oversubscribed. And so I was turning away tens of thousands of girls every year, which is why I was like, we have to write a book. And I know books can seem super analog, but I think that books can close the opportunity gap, and books can actually be put into the hands of every single girl in this country, teach them how to code.
Now, you actually wrote this for, I think it's age 8 through 12, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's written in that sort of language, and it's, I guess you can probably learn the basics of coding, but from what I saw of the book, it was more about explaining the concepts behind beginning to code.
Exactly. Like, you know, what is a variable or an algorithm, and how is it just like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? And what's also powerful about the book is it tells stories about the pioneers of computer science who were women, like Ada Lovelace and ENIAC and, you know, Katherine Johnson, who was, you know, the key role in Hidden Figures, a movie I'm sure a lot of, you know, your listeners have seen. And it tells the story of our girls who have built dress-up games or a seeing-eye robot to help, you know, someone who's blind cross the street. And it's inspiring because I really believe, Rich, girls fundamentally, they want to change the world. And we're showing them how exposure to technology and learning how to code can help you be a change maker.
Now, people probably haven't heard of Ada Lovelace.
Yes, and she was really a trailblazer. And she wrote all these powerful kind of papers on this that was kind of discovered later. And we often don't hear about these women. And it's so important for girls to learn, you know, the story of Ada Lovelace, who's literally the world's first computer programmer.
In fact, the person she was working with is the man generally credited with it.
Yes, the man was credited with it, exactly.
Well, also, as you got into this, you ran into something else, and you said you actually recognized it from your own life, a socialization that you feel like girls who code will help address this, but it's pervasive in our society. You call it the socialization of perfection.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Mm-hmm. I did a TED Talk on this. I think we raise our girls to be perfect, right? To smile pretty and play it safe and get all A's. And we raise our boys to, like, crawl to the top of the monkey bars and just jump off head first. And so we raise our young men to be fearless, to be risk takers, you know, to fail. And we raise our girls to get accolades and be perfect. And this really hurts them from taking real risks and from doing things that might not come to them right away. And that's the thing about programming, right? Programming is, it's an iterative process of trial and error. You know, that annoying semicolon's in the wrong place, you have to do it over and over and over again. It teaches you imperfection. And I think it's so important for our girls to learn how to be imperfect. You know, we see this with young boys. They're invigorated by a challenge. And for our girls, they think that there's a fixed mindset, that they're either good at something or bad at something. And so we haven't inspired them to want to learn how to try. And, you know, that's why at Girls Who Code, and in this book, we teach this. We teach the importance of bravery, of imperfection.
Now, you write in the book that says, you know, I experienced this in my own life. Your father would quiz you on math problems. Mm-hmm. I guess he was an engineer. Is that right?
My father's an engineer. Yeah. You know, they came here as refugees from Uganda. And, yeah, he, you know, at the dinner table, he'd be like, what's 2 + 2? And it, you know, the number 4 wouldn't come to me immediately, and so I got it in my head that I was bad at math. And it just stuck with me for my whole life. And that didn't feel good because I felt like there was a subject out there that I couldn't figure out, and I didn't know, and so I avoided it at all costs. And I think girls do that, you know, with a lot of subjects, with a lot of things in their life.
If they're not good at it immediately, if they're, and you write this as, you know, I was good at written language, history, language.
Yeah, debate.
Have you found that at Girls Who Code when you start working with a girl?
Absolutely.
They tend to shy away from things that they're not good at naturally?
I ask this question all the time. I'm like, do you think that you're either good at something or bad at something? Every hand shoots up. They really believe that their mindset is fixed. And so we have to unteach that. And oftentimes, you know, and teachers and parents in the most, you know, wonderful ways will say, oh, honey, you're really good at reading. Why don't you pursue that? And, you know, it's funny, I was working on a book about bravery, and I was talking to a parent. She was, like, you know, watching her sixth graders, like, award ceremony. And when the boys win awards, they kind of run up there with their hands up in the air. And when the girls win, they're like, oh, me? And put their hands over their face, right? This mocked modesty. And again, I think it all plays into this whole kind of narrative of, like, wanting to be liked, wanting to get everything perfect, you know, wanting to get a straight A so that the people feel good about them. And anything that they feel like doesn't allow them to get an A+, they don't want to do.
How difficult, when you're the people that are working with Girls Who Code, how difficult is that to overcome? I mean, I would think some girls can, and yeah, others probably give up.
See, I think coding overcomes that. Because
okay,
every girl that walks into our program thinks, wow, you've got to be a super genius to learn how to code. I'm not going to be able to do it. Maybe mom made me go. Maybe grandmother sent me to this class. And then they learn how to code, and they build something. And they're like, wow, I was wrong. Like, my mindset wasn't fixed. I actually could learn something and try and try and try, and it could actually, what I wanted to create could come to life. So that experience that they have with coding translates into so many other things, whether it's soccer or gymnastics or algebra, right? They suddenly realize that they can actually try to do something, get invigorated by a challenge, and get good at it.
In your TED Talk, you sort of related some of the conversations you had with some teachers. And can you relate a couple of those?
Yeah, the story I told in my TED Talk was how, you know, when girls are first learning how to code, in the first week, they kind of learn the basics. And most of our girls, again, come to our program with little to no experience in coding. And every teacher would start telling me the same story. She would say, you know, during that first week when girls were learning how to code, a student would call her teacher over, and she'd say, look at her and say, I don't know what code to write. And the teacher would look at the screen, and she'd see a blank text editor. So if she didn't know any better, she would have thought that her student spent the past 20 minutes just staring at the screen. But when the teacher pressed undo a few times, she saw that her student wrote code and then deleted it. So instead of showing the progress that she made, instead of showing her teacher, hey, I did this, what do you think? She rather showed nothing at all. Blank text editor. Because for girls, it's perfection or bust. There's no in between. And we have to unteach this. And this is what our book does.
Yeah,
it celebrates failure.
Yeah, there was a Columbia University professor you talked to who said,
yeah.
Tell us that story.
We had this, a CS teacher was telling me that, you know, when during office hours, you know, when the kids are struggling with the assignment, the boys will come in and they'll be like, ah, professor, you know, the computer's broken. The computer's broken. And the young women will come in and they'll say, I'm broken. There's something wrong with me.
Mm. That's a hard thing to overcome. I mean, this socialization you're talking about.
It is, but I believe it's never too late. And I really believe that it's about exercising your bravery muscle. Like, I do that. I mean, think about how crazy rich this is. I started Girls Who Code and I didn't code. You know, the chutzpah of that, right? And that happened because I ran for office and I lost and I didn't die. And so now I exercise my bravery muscle all the time, whether it's waking up one morning and saying, we're going to write a book and we're going to sell millions of copies, whether it's saying, I'm going surfing and I'm afraid of water and I can't swim. You know, it's like, how do you put yourself out of your comfort zone and try something new and let yourself fail and be bad at it and be energized by trying? I mean, when I went surfing last month, I didn't get up on the board. I tried. I was, like, freezing and crying, but it was exhilarating. And I'm going again, like, in 2 days. So it's like, I just feel like we have to find those types of opportunities in our life to teach us how to be brave. And I think once we start exercising our bravery muscle, it's with us forever.
My guest today is Reshma Sajani. She's the founder and CEO of Girls Who Code, former deputy public advocate for New York City. Her new book is titled Girls Who Code, Learn to Code and Change the World. Well, you know, you said you've reached 40,000 young women now. I assume this is going to take a major effort to really reverse this trend. I would think that major corporations would want to change this, but I mean, I know a lot of corporations are under pressure to have a more diverse workforce.
Yeah.
How are major computing corporations and technology companies responding to girls who
call?
Yeah,
they're all our partners. You know, because I think that even though this is hard, it's a problem we can solve. And like 95% of our graduates are going on to major in CS. And so every single company you can think of, from Facebook to Twitter to Adobe to Microsoft to Pixar to Disney, is a supporter of ours. In fact, I can't even think of a company that's not. Because they desperately need to hire engineers. I mean, almost 50% of executives say their number one problem is they can't find enough engineers. And, you know, quite frankly, they want to hire them here in Tulsa, not in India. And so the big opportunity for us is how do we retrain our workforce? Because in some ways, like, automation is also putting a lot of American workers into a lot of pain. But how do we turn that into an opportunity? And I see this all the time, Rich. I literally see girls that come to me from homeless shelters. And I teach them how to code. Girls Who Code teaches them how to code. So I don't think it's ever too late. I think that this is a skill set that anybody could pick up. That's why I tell parents, like, pick up this book. Pick up this book because you too will understand the basics. And it will instill in you some confidence, whether you want to take a longer 2-week course or a 5-week course or a 10-week course. Like, again, this problem is solvable. And I think that by teaching kids to code and families to code, we can literally have families march up into the middle class.
How well is the profession itself accepting women going into the field? And I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, in higher education as well as K-12, about getting young women into STEM fields.
Yeah.
But are there still barriers?
Honestly, you know, half of women who go to technology companies will leave within the first couple of years. A lot of that is culture. I mean, you're seeing this in stories over the past couple of months about in Silicon Valley. They have a huge culture problem that they have to fix. And I believe that the only way it gets fixed is if you flood the gates with women. And you've seen this happen in other industries, right? They were highly male-dominated. You saw a lot of HR problems. And then as more women and diverse people came into the labor force, it changed. And so I think it's fixable. And I do believe that these companies are committed to fixing it. I think in the schools we have a different problem. You know, I spoke to the National Governor Association a couple months ago, and I said, listen, we got to make computer science mandatory. Because when computer science is an elective, and you go into any classroom in the country, it's 80% boys and 20% girls. And until you fix culture, you know, which is, again, why we've written these books, because literary representation matters, until you fix culture, you won't change this. You know, and so you're essentially going to encourage more boys to code in the process. And so we have to keep our eyes on gender. And I told the governors of our country, you got to make sure we're reporting on gender so we're on track. You know, and I know we have a lot of governor of Arkansas, right, the governor of Oklahoma, huge, huge, huge advocates of our work and are very committed to this. So, you know, I feel good about our elected officials in terms of their commitment to creating gender parity.
You know, there's a lot of difficulties in filling the education jobs in the first place because,
yeah,
first of all, if you have the skills, you can make a lot more money,
yep,
in the field than teaching the field. I would think that would make it more difficult to get gender equity within the teaching.
You're absolutely right. I mean, look at your option, right? You can, if you graduate in computer science, you can make $120,000 at Facebook, or you can make $40,000 as a public school teacher with no benefits. I mean, that's a huge opportunity cost. So I've, you know, really strongly advocate for us thinking about how do we offer loan forgiveness programs? How do we, you know, create incentives for people to come into the classroom, you know, and see it as, you know, a part of kind of your obligation as an American? You know, we have to see it this way because, you know, China graduated 350,000 engineers last year. We are so far behind this when it comes to other nations. And again, I really believe that a lot of American families, because of automation, are really suffering. And so we got to train our workforce, and we got to do it yesterday.
So, what are the next steps for Girls Who Code? What are your next steps for the organization?
Yeah, we want to teach millions of girls, and you know, this book is a big part of that. We are releasing not just the first book, Learn to Code, Change the World, and Friendship Code, which is a fiction book. But we have an entire 13-book series. Because, again, I really believe that books can be put in the hands of girls across the country. We've been doing book donations at libraries across the country. So, you know, get this book for your daughter. Get this book for your niece, because I think that we can reach millions. We want to get it in the syllabus of schools. You know, we want it to be on summer reading lists. This book, it's not like, you know, eat your raisins. It's fun. Like, it's like a fun book. Like, girls are getting hooked on it because it's fun and it's interesting and you want to learn more. And I think that's the important part, right, of getting girls to see, like, technology is fun. It's like you can change the world. You can build cool things. You can make wearable jewelry. Like, you know, we got to meet with girls where they're at. So it's all about this book.
Now, you mentioned the friendship code. I think this is even a younger book, right?
Yes. Well, it's slightly younger, but it's basically like the babysitting club. And it's about five girls that meet in a coding club and the adventures and the mysteries and the drama and the boys and, you know, and our first series of friendship, the first of the series is coming out. It just came out in last week with Learn to Code and Change the World. And it's awesome.
Is that, again, to go into school libraries as sort of an early reader?
Yeah, like a chapter series, yep.
To introduce this concept to girls.
And to do it through in a fun way, right? So it's like the friendship code is about a mystery. And, you know, some of the girls weren't friends, and they come to the coding club, and they become friends again. And, you know, there's drama, and we sneak in a little bit of algorithms and variables. And so, you know, you walk away from the book reading a really good story, but learning a little bit of the basics.
Now, if you're wildly successful, I assume, are you looking to like start chapters around the country, or do you?
So we have Girls of Code clubs in every single state. Mm-hmm. So yes, our goal is to make have this book also kick off thousands and thousands and thousands of clubs across the country. You know, so we have clubs in many of the cities that your listeners are in, but we want more, and the clubs are free. You know, you don't have to be technical to teach. You know, just sign up on our website at girlswhocode.com. Tell us you're interested, and we'll get one started.
Also, I noticed that, you know, this is a part of a nationwide movement. I know in our community now there's like a higher math circle. Again, do you think that's, again, a sort of this idea of this socialization that you're talking about combat that?
I also just think that, like, the workforce is changing. Like, we need American women to put food on the table and to pay the mortgage. And so we got to have them in these future jobs because they pay really well. And we need their brains. You know, we need to be innovating every day. And we can't leave out half of our labor force. We'll just lose out as a country if we do that.
Now, I was struck by something you did say in the TED Talk, was just, you know, there's this irony that women shy away from these technological fields when oftentimes they're the largest consumer of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, right? Because women make 80% of all consumer purchases. So we're huge consumers of technology. And the question is how do we make ourselves creators? And that's the link we need to make to our young girls.
Well, it's a great concept, the idea of these groups where girls come together, learn to code, and hopefully follow through with more science education, technological education, and follow that through into college. The name of the group is Girls Who Code. That's also the name of the book written by my guest today, Reshma Sajani. I wish you great success.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate being here. Thank you so much.
Reshma Sajani is the founder and CEO of Girls Who Code, a national nonprofit and author of the book of the same name. It's published by Viking. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
Claudette, my friend, had a horrendous last year dying. There were trips to MD Anderson, chemotherapy, radiation, hospital stays, infection, specialists. There was burning, insomnia, exhaustion. There was, well, you know what there was. And when she died, it was miserable and painful, and she was bald. She had great hair, and she died without it. And what did she get out of it? The fight, I mean. What was the point of all that suffering? What did medicine in all its glory give her? An extra month of life? Six? Maybe? Filled with what? Nausea and sickness and fear and thrush and God knows what else? Were they worth it? Is that living? And what did it all cost? Of course it doesn't matter what it cost. You want to fight, not give up. You do whatever it takes to survive another day, another hour. Money is not the thing. unless it is, unless it can buy you something other than a slow death. I wonder if there's a time, say, at the time of the diagnosis, the time when the extent of the evil inside you is realized, if someone from insurance were to say to you, "We know this cancer. You're covered. Don't worry. And we're going to spend more than $1 million on something, let's face it, that's not going to work. We all know that. And you'll be in pain through most of it, but we have an idea. If you want, only if you want, skip the doctors. We'll send you the million. Forget fighting the disease. Do you take the deal?" And what if you took the money earmarked for tamoxifen and MRIs and doctors whose names you can't pronounce and bumpy ambulance trips and biopsies and cases of insure and decided instead to pay off your mortgage? Tell your boss to go to hell. Get a dog, a big dog. Name him Bobby. And fly to Munich for starters because you hear they have great licorice over there. And then, like Gump of sorts, decide to run, walk, you and Bobby the big dog, across Europe to Prague to see Turandot because you're a sucker for Nessun Dorma. And you really don't want to sleep and don't want anyone else to sleep either. To Poland to try to find where your ancestors lived and fled the Nazis and where war started and ended. To the bed of a stranger you met in a coffee shop over espresso and pound cake with vanilla icing and make love in a flat with casement windows and where, in the morning, you leave, and maybe you leave a note but probably don't. To tacky gift shops in cities where Bobby the big dog sits outside and drinks water from a bowl set out by the owners. To the ocean, to the mountains, to mosques and temples and churches and libraries, to an airport where you put Bobby the big dog on a flight home to a friend because you feel like you're dying and you can't bear the thought of leaving him alone in Portugal or wherever you are, to an orphanage to make a donation and where you make sure they know your name because, unlike your unknown lover with the great windows, you want to be remembered, want these people, these children, to know that you were. And then finally to a 3-star hotel in Barcelona where you take your last remaining pain pill, which is no longer working, and lean your head back on an ungodly number of pillows, down pillows, and hope death comes quickly and easily and tonight because the television is on, and turn to Law and Order in Spanish, and that seems just about perfect. You look at the screen, see yourself in its reflection and the flickering light, and you smile, and you start to pound the mattress first with one fist, then the other, then both arms and legs, again and again, up and down, because you can see it clearly. Superimposed over Lenny Briscoe, you have all your hair. Damn it, you have all your hair.
Barry Friedman is a writer and essayist and a columnist for the Tulsa Voice and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.